This is the third talk that I'm giving on continual modeling. And basically, in this talk, I'm going to focus on a couple of problems, mainly on this one, and then I'll give some flavor of this. Sam, not at all an expert in this. This is basically the topic of the fourth workshop. But I'll give some flavor of what goes on for this problem. I'm not an expert here either, but I can tell you some of the things that we've done. And a bit of the literature. So I'm going to talk about angiogenesis and neovascularization in the context of solid tumor growth. So the idea here, is basically the picture, is that you have a sequence of genetic mutations that occurs to form basically a cancer cell, and that cancer cell is going to divide and form a small tumor spheroid on the order of a micron or 2 microns in diameter. And at early stages, so on the order of a few days, this will eventually reach a stable size, basically because since there's no blood vessels connected to it, the nutrients, so oxygen and glucose, will diffuse basically into the tumor, and it can only support so basically you have the diffusional limitation, so you have this very small size. And so what happens is that the core of the tumor, because the nutrient can't reach, becomes necrotic and dies, while at the same time still the outer tumor cells are proliferating, and so that you get a dynamic equilibrium. So roughly the tumor stays on the micron size.
So my understanding is the vector should grow into the tumor.
Oh, they will.
Yeah.
So while this process is going on, the cells that are dying, essentially, are releasing chemical factors, angiogenic factors, that are calling for blood vessels, or basically the endothelial cells that line the vessels, to grow towards the tumor.
Into the tumor.
Yeah, they'll eventually, they have to grow to it to get there.
So
they grow towards it. And as they're growing towards it, when they eventually loop, they can start providing additional new flow. That flow can then create additional nutrient that can help to supply the tumor. And this process of the growth of new blood vessels is angiogenesis. And then eventually the vessels will penetrate the tumor. And at this point, basically the tumor can become malignant. Basically, it can metastasize by having cells escape into the blood system because these vessels are typically very leaky.
Probably already malignant.
Quite possibly.
Yeah.
Quite possibly.
It can grow faster.
Yes. Yes. It could be malignant without the vessels.
Yeah. Right.
Absolutely. So the process of angiogenesis goes somewhat like this. So basically, the tumor is releasing, so the tumor, or more or less the cells that are undergoing hypoxia, are releasing the angiogenic factors. So, for example, vascular endothelial growth factor. This then calls for the endothelial cells that line the vessels to start migrating and also proliferating. The tumor is strongly interacting with the extracellular matrix, as is the endothelial cells, as well as other cells such as mast cells and macrophages. So what I want to do is now connect that with solid tumor growth and show a model that couples the two processes. So for the solid tumor growth model, basically, we're going to have it's very idealized, again, continuum level ideal model, where we basically have some big region that we're going to look at around the tumor. The tumor is inside this guy whose boundary is we'll call sigma, and that inside so this is the tumor region. This you can think of as the microenvironment, the healthy or non-cancerous region surrounding the tumor. And inside the tumor, you can have the proliferating zone that's written here as omega P. So those are is a region where cells are, there's enough nutrient for cells to proliferate. And also a necrotic core where, for example, the the conditions are such that the cells can't survive. So call that omega n. And then in addition, you you can have regions of non-cancerous tissue or non-cancerous cells that are trapped within the overall tumor. And so we're going to focus on a continuum approximation. So we're at a supercell level. We're not going to track individual cells, but we'll describe some averaged equations. And we'll look at the role of cell adhesion and motility on the invasion process and the coupling between the growth and the angiogenesis. Now, the typically cancer cells are very genetically unstable, and so within we haven't studied that aspect as much, but within the context of the continuum modeling, you can incorporate genetic changes via random changes, so spatial dependence and spatial random space and time dependence of the microphysical parameters. So we take a very simple tumor model, which is basically kind of assuming that the tumor is an behaving like an incompressible fluid with a source. So in other words, the only stress is pressure. There's no residual stress, and that's a place I'll just at least at the end mention perhaps a little bit. So you can then talk about some kind of average cell velocity U and a pressure P. Basically, if we define a cell velocity U, then we can talk about the local rate of area change or volume change. So the change in volume locally should be given by, well, what happens with the cells. So either proliferation in the proliferative zone or degradation in the necrotic region. It's very simplified. In the proliferative zone, you have mitosis. So sigma is a nutrient. You can think of that as glucose, nutrient concentration. And lambda m is essentially a mitosis rate. And then also you can have programmed cell death or apoptosis. So basically, after a certain number of cell divisions, the cell will commit suicide and will die. And then within the context of this simple model, you can relate that as a volume loss. Because in this simple model, by writing the rate, the local change in volume, I'm assuming inherently that the tumor cell density is constant. And within the proliferating rim, that's not such an unreasonable assumption. But nevertheless, it is an assumption which is not completely true. So this tells you how, and so now, why is there loss terms? Well, if you have death and your density is constant, then you should have volume loss. And physically, biophysically, what's going on is that the cells are broken down. Now, so these drive volume changes, and through a relation, basically a Darcy-Stokes relation, so assuming that it's more or less behaving like a viscous fluid, you can relate the velocity to viscous fluid through a porous medium, basically, to the gradient of a pressure with a mobility term. And so basically volume changes create a pressure, gradients in that pressure create motion.
John, in the Darcy-Stokes law there, is that be the material derivative of U in front of the...
No, it's because it's a, so if it were Darcy's law, I would just have that. So it's just relation between velocity and pressure. So not the Navier-Stokes equation. So the Navier-Stokes equation, I would put the material derivative. And then I have. And so this is simpler than that. I'm not considering inertia.
Actually, a related question, where does the other term come from then? Is that a particular model you're
putting? Which one, sorry?
The new grad.
Oh, yes. So this is a,
That's unusual.
Well, it's called it comes in porous media. So this is like a next order term that you can include.
Because of the, okay.
Right.
So it's the expansion.
That's right. And technically, there are models in which you do this. Technically, you'd have to be careful about it. This should be a really small parameter.
Right, that's why I'm asking.
Yes.
Is it Laplacian or is it?
It's Laplacian. So you can think of this as a kind of smoothing for the mathematicians, a smoothing operator on you.
Is that what you need, though, for the numerics?
For the
numerics.
That's
what I'm getting at.
Yes.
That's exactly, because it's not part of the Darcy-Stokes law. It's a method for smoothing.
No, but it is also, it does have some physical justification when you do the expansion in porous media. But we put it in here because it does give an extra regularization, but we have also methods. For the method I'll show here, it's necessary, but we also have other methods where it's not necessary, and you do just pure Darcy. It doesn't make a big effect on the result. So, in addition, we have also the cancer cells and the healthy cells have physical differences, and there's adhesion, cell-to-cell adhesion. So, in other words, the cancer cells actually prefer to be with the cancer cells. And so, within a very simple model like this, one can introduce that effect through a surface tension. Because basically, surface tension is just the thermodynamic imbalance between molecular forces. And so one can put that in here through a jump in the pressure. I should be a little bit more careful about it, but if I think of this nu as constant everywhere, then it's just this guy. Now, let me make the connection with angiogenesis. So basically, this necrotic region is the region, we're going to do a very simple model, we're just going to say that this is the region where the nutrient concentration, this guy, is less than some viability threshold, sigma m. So, yeah.
Can I ask a question, just going back to the material constants, the surface tension?
Yes.
So this is the pressure drum condition you're going to take across, there are three types of interfaces, right? It's the necrotic with gamma.
Correct.
P,
so this will be the
healthy with gamma.
That's
P,
right.
There's that with the outside, and they're all going to have the same tension, all same viscosity.
No. This one is only going to be for the one between the tumor and the healthy tissue.
So it's like the envelope, the microcellular environment.
That's right. And for the other type, so for example, between the tumor and the necrotic region, we assume the pressure is continuous there. But that's a simplifying assumption. Probably there should also be a different surface tension, different adhesion there.
Okay.
Yeah. So this necrotic region is where the nutrient is less than this viability threshold. And it's cells essentially in this region that are going to be, in our model, releasing angiogenic factor. And so this region, in some sense, is an input to the angiogenesis model. So that's a way you can connect.
Do you have any shear terms in there or something like this?
Yeah, there's no shear boundary conditions.
So I haven't said what we do in the far field boundary. Is that what you're asking?
No, I was wondering, you do have like pressure gradients in the system, but no shear.
So this envelope that you have besides
yes.
the normal pressure drum, do you have any other information about the shear, the tangential shear along that?
No, we don't impose any. Yeah, so we don't impose that. Right. Just
the
normal.
The origin of the pressure is a hydrostatic pressure?
Yes, so the pressure is arising because cells are proliferating and pushing on each other. Yes. So.
Any drainage due to wind?
We haven't put that in the model, but that explicitly, but it's kind of put it implicitly here, through the fact that you have, when cells are dying, you have volume losses. So implicitly, that's it. That's a very averaged effect. So that's, in some sense, the mechanics. Now, the mechanics needs to be coupled with something for an equation for the nutrient, which is essentially a reaction diffusion equation. So basically, nutrient changes due to diffusion, consumption, and source due to blood vessels. So let's talk about each term. So this term, basically the diffusion of nutrient occurs very rapidly, basically on the order of a minute, compared to the time scale of growth of a tumor, so in other words, the mitosis time scale, which is on the order of a day. So essentially, from this continuum model point of view, you can drop this term, it's quasi-steady. The diffusion field is going to equilibrate much faster than the tumor is going to evolve. So essentially, you'll just have a steady state reaction diffusion equation for the nutrient. Now, for the blood, so the source due to the blood, so this basically is a transfer function that's going to release, it's going to model the release of the nutrient, for example, glucose, from the blood vessels. And this is an output of angiogenesis. And that function should be a function of the difference between the nutrient concentration in the blood and the nutrient concentration in the tissue, as well as the pressure in the blood and the pressure in the tissue, because if the pressure in the tissue is too high, you're not going to get transfer.
The pressure in the tumor is always higher than the pressure in the surrounding medium, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, at the, in the center, so but not necessarily away.
So how do you, so if that's the case, then how do you drive the oxygen up the gradient?
No, it's only in the center of the tumor, but away from the tumor, the pressure can be lower. So you're going to have more release away from the tumor. Or right at the boundary. Not necessarily going to get inside and release.
Another thing is the tumor growth doesn't require oxygen. Without oxygen, tumor can grow faster.
It requires something, which is glucose.
That's the requirement.
Well, but it has to get glucose from somewhere too, right? So it's going to get it from the blood.
Yeah.
Oxygen is required because that's what necrosis is.
People found the tumor cell can grow faster in the absence of oxygen.
Well, and so it can undergo glycolysis, so where basically it switches the pathway from oxygen-based to glucose-based. Here we're modeling, it's again a very macro scale continuum model where we're modeling one important nutrient factor, which you can think of as glucose. So the cell cycling model, so this mitosis rate, we're going to take something very simple, just a constant times the nutrient concentration. So in other words, the larger the nutrient concentration, the more proliferation. Now, of course, there's a very simple model. Really, one should use something like a Michaelis-Menten model for this, so that, in other words, you have a saturation above a particular nutrient concentration. But our nutrient, basically, when we're non-dimensionalizing, is going to be somewhere between 0 and 1. So it's a reasonable model. For the blood-tissue transfer function, basically, we're going to take a very simple function. There'll be a transfer rate, lambda b. There'll be a function h, which here is going to be the difference in nutrient concentration, but then supported on the capillary. So in other words, there's going to be the source, but it's supported only where there's the capillaries. And then also times this difference in pressure, so that in other words, this plus just means that if this quantity is negative, it's zero, and if it's positive, then you take its value. So that's just saying that you don't do anything if the pressure inside the tissue is bigger than the blood pressure. And then now we're going to couple the two models and look at the nonlinear interaction between the vasculature and the tumor growth. But this was all the tumor growth part of the model.
The support capillary is unknown, right?
Yes, that's unknown. We'll have to determine that. And so now to determine the support of that capillary, we're going to have to model the angiogenesis process. And so Howard is an expert in that. Basically, there's a, just wanted to point, there's a journal of angiogenesis specialized for this.
Oh, and which one?
Say again?
Can you tell me the details of what journal? So
that is the name
of the journal.
Okay. Right.
So just search for angiogenesis and you'll find it, published by Kluwer. So basically, there's a bunch of angiogenic factors that play a major role in the angiogenesis process. So again, here's just a cartoon above it. So you have a tumor, you have the growth factor. So in this case, they're talking about their, the cartoon is for VEGF, so this vascular endothelial cell growth factor. And then you see basically the cartoon of the sprouts and eventually penetrating the tumor. And here's the metastasis that can occur by the two cells escaping into the blood supply. But of course, as Howard pointed out, you can have metastasis even before this, where the tumor can break up or cells move off. So I want to just talk about a particular I'm going to focus on a particular angiogenic factor, so this VEGF, and just tell you some ideas that were actually found here. This is Luisa Rella-Arispe, who is a molecular biologist at UCLA, who actually, we got started looking at this problem as part of actually the organization of this program. So she's another organizer, and she was telling us about this, and we thought it was very interesting. So what they focused on was the angiogenic response to different isoforms of this vascular endothelial growth cell factor A. So this is a picture basically of the growth factor, VEGF-A, and it really has basically three parts. So one part is the part that binds to the receptors on the cell. Another part is the part that binds to the extracellular matrix. And then there's a last part, which I'm not sure what it does. Now, what they found is that they're able to then to, that depending on the form that this takes, so this is the general, the so-called wild type form, but the actual response, but there can be non-wild type forms which occur because various parts of this protein essentially can be cleaved. So let me describe the different types of cleaving, and then I'll say how it comes up. So, let me say how it comes up first. So the basic form, so this guy, can be changed, in other words, cleaved, parts of it cut off, due to the fact that you can have matrix metalloproteinases that are basically degradation proteinases that are secreted, for example, by endothelial cells, but also by tumor cells that degrade the extracellular matrix, provide a way for the, for example, the endothelial cells to move through the matrix towards the tumor, and also for the tumor to grow. These, at the same time, while degrading the matrix, can also cut these proteins and cut the VEGF. So when that happens, it turns out the response of the vasculature is very different. So for example, there's one isoform, I guess the one that's cut is this one. So if this part is totally cut off, the part that binds to the ECM, then this part has the piece that binds to the receptor, but not to the extracellular matrix, so it's fully soluble. And they also were able to engineer a form of this guy, so that's this one, which is insensitive to the metalloproteinases. So in other words, it can't be cleaved, always is insoluble. And what they found is that the results for the vascularization are very different. If it's soluble, so in other words, it has this part bound that you would ordinarily bind to the ECM cut off, you would have very large vessels that were chaotically distributed, and as I'll show you, not very good at supplying blood to the tumor. If they were insoluble, In other words, this form, so it's not affected by the, it's this one. This is the original same picture, but it's this one that's not affected by the metalloproteinases. They cut off a few things that the proteinases hit. Then you get a highly dense system of vessels that are very, very narrow and actually very good at supplying the tumor with blood and nutrient. So now why is this important? Well, one of the reasons it's important is because, well, of course, you want to understand how the different mechanisms work. But one way of measuring the extent of angiogenesis is, for example, taking a sample of blood and measuring angiogenic factors. Now, the point here is that in the blood supply, you're going to find mostly the soluble form. And if the soluble form is a poor prognosticator of the effective angiogenesis, then in some sense you may think things are really bad when they may not be as bad as you might expect. Yeah?
I was just going to say, in the simulations we did, the angiogenesis in vitro, you had to have a relatively low diffusion constant of the primary VEGF isoform. And so, in fact, it was critical for the morphology of the vesicles that we got in our simulations whether you were dependent on the low mobility VEGF isoforms, which basically bound to ECM and therefore diffused very slowly, or the high mobility VEGF isoforms, which didn't give you sprouting angiogenesis.
Yep.
So in fact, we saw that in our simulations as well. So it really, and the difference in mobility between these isoforms could be a factor of 10 to the 3.
Mm-hmm.
So there are huge differences in the effective diffusion constants of these various isoforms. This is really, it's really nice to see this slide.
Okay. They also looked at the basically the effect of in the absence of a tumor, but in the presence of growth factors. So in other words, you have a bead that's surrounded by endothelial cells and embedded in a gel. And depending on the isoform, so this is the wild type, this is the soluble type, and then this is the insoluble type that's insensitive to the metalloproteinases, you see very different morphologies that arise from the cell. So basically you see from this guy, you see something that looks like sheets, this guy's cords, and this is some combination of the two. Just another picture where they looked at they put a little gel cap on top of a mouse, essentially, that's containing the growth factors, and they looked at the different vessels that form within this gel. And again, want to point out, if we look at the big difference, so here's the soluble one, so you have vessels that look very big, highly dilated. Here's the insoluble one, so you have very tiny vessels, a lot of them. And then here's the wild type. So it strongly depends on the type. And now here's the comparison with the actual tumor growth. So this is this center region is the tumor, and the wild type gives a particular tumor size. Here's the soluble version, and they wanted to point out the tumor is white, indicating little penetration by blood vessels, and it's actually the smallest. And here's the insoluble one where the tumor is much bigger.
Yeah.
So the insoluble one is the one that, and here's the vessels that are just a little bit away from the tumor. So you see many dense, very tiny vessels. So this one is most effective, this type is most effective in vascularizing the tumor.
Would you say, what's the last panel in black and white? It's adjacent skin.
So this is a little bit away, And then this is farther way up by the skin, so indicating there's there still are differences, even far away.
Through the vascular network.
Yeah, it's more or less, yes, right, looking basically that way.
So John, these isoforms of BDGF are basically local to the solid tumor receptor? What's the signal to the capillary?
So the way I'm thinking about it, and I'm not sure it's completely right, but the way I think about it is that you're producing either in this case the tumor is producing the VEGF, but it also there's these metalloproteinases around. And so what they've done here is, so it's all local to the tumor.
Okay.
Yeah. And then here they've transfected the cells so they only produce this type.
How are they knocking down the wild type VEGF?
That you have to ask them, so that I'm not sure. But they transfect the cell so that it only produces this. That's essentially my answer.
So they have a dominant negative.
Yes.
Is this true of all tumors, or is this specific type of tumor?
I think it's generally true.
My experience in this business is that nothing you say about one tumor is true.
No, but I think what's clear though is that these very basic ideas, right? So
yeah.
You have things that are cells that are moving through the matrix, so they have to degrade the matrix. And then the point here is that there's an important interaction between the matrix and the angiogenesis, angiogenic response. That's not just the scaffolding itself that it's traveling on, but it's also the fact that you have these proteins in there, and then if these metalloproteinases, degrading enzymes, essentially change the protein structure, then you can change the angiogenic response dramatically. And so basically we then take a version of the angiogenic models that have been in the literature, basically based on the work of Anderson and Chaplin, but many others, including Howard and others. So we take the version that basically Vittorio Cristini developed in work with Xiaoming Zhang and Stephen Weiss. And so basically, it's a very basic model. There have been many more sophisticated models developed recently. So the basic model is you have an equation for essentially the capillary, this density of the capillary cells. An equation for the angiogenic factor, and an equation that's modeling very roughly the extracellular matrix. So in this framework, E is the endothelial cell density, and so E is going to satisfy a reaction diffusion equation that's going to take into account, random diffusion. Now here you could ask, why don't I drop the time derivative? I don't drop the time derivative here because I'm looking at a cell population, so its motion is on the same order, also it's going to proliferate too, will be on the same time scale as the tumor growth. So here I have to leave the time derivative. Random diffusion, which the coefficient is typically very small, then it moves in response to the chemical factors, so via chemotaxis. Also, it moves in response to haptotaxis, so that's essentially a response to gradient of adhesiveness in the matrix. And so we can model that through fibronectin, which is essentially an adhesion molecule. And then in addition, the cells can move if the overall tissue is moving, it moves with the tissue. And that's our cell velocity. And then, at the same time, you can have proliferation, and proliferation will occur if you're above a critical, this is basically a logistic term that will turn off proliferation if you get above a particular density. It'll drive you back down. You can only proliferate if you have enough angiogenic factor, and this is just a Heaviside function, 0 to 1, and then this is the amount you do is proportional to that guy.
Is this H still the one that's supported on the capillary?
No, this is just a Heaviside function, so 0, 1. So there's, I haven't introduced the capillary yet.
Okay. So can I make a comment?
Uh-huh.
So you said that the proliferation depends on the threshold, right?
It's going to depend on the threshold angiogenic factor, level of angiogenic factor.
Yeah, well, then my understanding is the tumor cell always the proliferate.
No, this is not tumor cell. This is endothelial cell.
Okay.
Endothelial cells only proliferate if there's enough angiogenic factor.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not. This is not tumor cell.
Just to understand how the two pieces are going to fit together, then. So this is a model just for the lining of the capillary. Somehow this is going to feed into something else that generates the surface of the capillary, and that creates your
right.
What was it? The delta, the H.
That's
basically
right. Exactly. Right. Right. So let me get there.
Yep, I'm just trying to make sure. I'm
Yeah. Right. So basically you have these two separate models and they're going to couple through that term in two places. So the two models are going to couple first through the, so I'll give it here. So this is the equation for the angiogenesis factor, so think of the VEGF. And so this guy is a it's a reaction diffusion collision, but this is quasi-steady again because this is an angiogenic factor, so that diffuses very fast compared to the growth. So you have diffusion, it can decay, and then it's also uptaken by the endothelial cells. Okay. And now here's the coupling to the mechanical model that we're going to assume a boundary, this is non-dimensional, we're going to assume a boundary condition of 1 on the necrotic region. So that's just saying that on the necrotic core, the cells are producing that's the source of angiogenic factor. So that's the first coupling back to, from this point of view. Actually, there's another piece, there's the velocity. But it's a coupling back to the mechanical model.
Was that the same velocity that you had?
This one is the same velocity. Yeah, so because we're saying that if the tissue moves, the cells are going
to
move with it. Now the fibronectin, so this adhesive molecule, is going to, this one doesn't diffuse, so you just have just an ODE, but depends on spatial location, so space is a parameter here. And so it's produced by the endothelial cells. It's also, it can be degraded and consumed by the endothelial cell.
No
advection here.
Because it's solid tumor growth?
Well, because this is basically adhering to the matrix. Yes.
Yeah, but you're distorting the matrix.
But I'm distorting the matrix. We could have put an advection term here, but we didn't.
Well, it makes your life much harder if you do it.
Yeah, that's true. But we have all these methods, so.
How many unknown variables are there? Everything's put together, is it order 10, 20? All these like chi C's and alphas and EOs and everything else you guys.
So for the mechanical model, there's essentially five or six parameters for the mechanical model. You can turn off a number of them, but that would be the most general. And then here you have, these are the additional, let's see, so basically I can remove one, and so I have two in this. I can remove, one here, so another two. This I can probably drop. And then I have, these would be the primary ones, so this one, and then another called the centurion. So it's a lot of parameters.
You write a lot of papers.
A number of the parameters you can get from experiments, but others you just don't know. So now let me say, without giving the equations, let me say how you would then get the capillaries, because that's the next phase. So the idea is that we use this, we follow the approach of Anderson and Chaplin, where you use a mixed continuum discrete model. So you have this continuum model, And that gives you, you know, let's focus on this one, it gives you the equation for the endothelial cell density. Now the idea is seed the within your, let's say, numerical grid, you have a few capillaries that are seeded, capillary initiation points that are seeded, and then you allow the, so then what you do is you track those, the tips, the endpoints of those. And what you have to do is say, okay, now from one time step to the next, where do those guys go? And you do that based on a discrete, basically the numerical version of this equation, where you decide, are you going to move forward, left, right, and so on. So you can base it on a series of probabilities based on that are weighted based on the chemical fields that are present on the continuum wall. So it's kind of a heuristic model.
This is not the one where they randomize the coefficients.
This is not the one where the coefficients are randomized.
That's good.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
So to give it, it's a little bit hard to see, but to give a picture, so this is a picture of a tumor. The tumor boundary is here. There's an adaptive mesh, and you can see capillaries here. I'll give more pictures, better pictures in a minute. We use this unstructured adaptive triangulated mesh. So the mesh is going to refine around the tumor boundary, but also around the capillaries. The color means basically is involved in the age here. It's a blow up. You can see it a little bit better. And now this is going to couple back into the mechanical model, because along these capillaries, if the capillaries have looped, for example, like this one, then we'll release nutrient there. And then, so that will be a source of nutrient, and then that nutrient will then diffuse and can provide an extra source for the tumor. Okay, and so that's the back coupling of the angiogenic model back onto the mechanical model. And so here's an example of essentially the experiment you guys had done, where we have now the tumor. In this case, I'm going to fix the this boundary of the tumor. And just allow the proliferation and the whole process to go on, but I'm not going to move the tumor boundary. Essentially, when we did this experiment, we were thinking of a tissue scaffold, actually. And so we were trying to, the cells were seated inside the scaffold, and then they were releasing angiogenic factors that were calling the blood vessels. So these are capillary sprouts, essentially. So these are local centers of endothelial cells. So imagine the blood vessel coming out of the board. And then what you do is you track these, essentially you can't see them, but there's points there. The points grow in length due to the discrete model. That's what the original mesh looks like. And then they grow and eventually form the grow towards the tumor. So in the case when the diffusion constant is very small, in other words, the insoluble case, then the growth is right towards, very direct, well-directed towards the scaffold.
So I don't quite understand that diagram. You've got the circle represents the tumor, is that right?
Think of it, yes, the circle represents the tumor.
Okay.
And sorry, the black region inside here is the necrotic core.
Okay.
Okay. And so the angiogenic factors are going to be released from here.
Okay.
Okay. And now in this case, they're essentially insoluble. So I'll show you exactly how I did that in a second.
Okay. But you've seeded.
And I've seeded, pre-seeded a bunch of capillaries here.
Are those blue dots supposed to be individual cells?
Those are contours of the endothelial cell concentration. And in there, what you can't see is a dot, which is the original initial capillary. So remember, it's a continuum discrete model. So I have the continuous field. The blue or cyan is the contour of the continuous field. And then I have a discrete thing I'm also tracking, which is inside there, but you just don't see it because
it's
a
dot.
It's basically just as you see it. We have a circle,
yeah,
And then, you know, whatever the ratio, I mean, these are much smaller than the radius of the circle. I guess,
right.
I'm not sure.
Are these capillaries that have already grown from some other?
No, this is the initial condition.
Okay.
This is the initial condition. So we start basically by preceding, so assuming we have this many capillaries, and in each one there's a point, and that point is the sprout tip.
So these are really quite close already.
They're quite close to the tumor already.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now if the, if we're assuming insoluble, so I'll say exactly in a second how we model that, but you can think of that as a small diffusion constant, then the capillaries grow directly towards the tumor, and the different colors, essentially red is indicating looped vessels. So those would be the ones that are releasing releasing nutrients. If it's partially soluble, this is the same time period, which means that you have a bit larger diffusion constant. They also reach the tumor, but don't penetrate as much. And if it was fully soluble, basically nothing happens.
Can you I realize this is based on a detailed model, but you could have figured this out if you just had an approximate idea of the transport you're trying to model. I mean, you could have guessed this before you did any of the simulations.
Yes, that's right.
Just based on the symmetry, based on the diffusion coefficients, you kind of...
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. Now, what I don't know and what I've been pushing them to do is to say, is this the right picture? Because that's the, so in other words, is it just simple diffusion constants? Or is it the fact that the cells actually respond differently? So that's another possibility. Because, if we go back to the equation, and you can even just think about it in terms of the equation. So you have chi C. So you have different chi C for now the different isoforms. So one possibility for turning off the chemotaxis is that the chi C for the soluble one is much smaller. So I've asked them to do an experiment, and they've done something along those lines, but I don't have the info to report yet.
Well, you have a prediction, which is that only that the diffusion constant by itself is sufficient to explain the observation.
Correct. Right, but that may not be. But I think I could also explain the observation by solely changing that.
Yeah, I agree. But
right. So now, so that's the point. That's the value now, right? Because they weren't
I'm not
thinking
saying
of
there's
those.
No value in doing it. I'm
no, 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 no. But I'm saying, but
yeah.
What I'm saying now is that now you can go back, and they didn't ask that question at the beginning. They just saw the observation. So now you can actually go back, and I mean, we didn't have to do the simulation to tell them that.
Mm-hmm.
But now you can motivate them to do another experiment to try to figure out which it is.
Yeah.
This is just a mesh. Now. Here was something that intrigued us, but it's obvious when you think about it. So basically, for the insoluble isoform, what we more or less did is that we allowed it to diffuse and then froze in the diffusion field. Okay, and then what was intriguing, so the difference between this guy and the partly soluble guy, is that when you freeze in the field after it's developed, it doesn't remodel, of course, spatially. And so as the cells move towards the tumor, you create steeper gradients because they're being consumed. And so, in fact, the process is accelerating.
Yeah, well, we knew that. I mean, we've done that calculation with the other model.
Yeah.
That was an observation of Fulton, actually. Experimentally, you observed the acceleration.
Right. And then if it's partially soluble, so now you can allow it to remodel, then the response is less strong. And of course, if it's soluble so that the diffusion constant was very large, then you don't have any gradients. So all very standard. This is just what happens at later times. Just to show that you do have a development, but the development is very irregular in the soluble case because you do have some gradients. Because the diffusion constant is not infinity, and you are creating, so you do have some gradient, but it moves more or less in random direction. Just to show a picture of how that goes. So this is the insoluble case. So you see, you know, nice. Does it nice and penetrating? And then the soluble case, it just does what you would expect. It's gonna just go everywhere.
Could you do the left one every time one so fast?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so it goes right in. And so we've been then working to develop more sophisticated models, because basically we were doing it with just a fusion constant, but in fact you should account for the metalloproteinases, which actually cleave, and so you should have a couple of different population sizes, and so on. But let me continue on with this. Here is basically now doing the model where we're going to allow the boundary to move of the tumor. So here it's not going to move too much, but it'll move some. So now we're not preceding. When the level of angiogenic factor is high enough, we're going to get capillaries that form. And in the soluble case, you see they move directly in to the tumor. And then the tumor also is going to selectively grow towards the capillaries because they're providing the nutrients. So I'll show that one more time. So you see they form. There's this nucleation criterion. In the insoluble case, it does exactly what you would expect. The capillaries, when they do, because you do have the angiogenic factor, but they more or less go in all directions.
Wait a second, they go away from the tumor?
They also go away from the tumor, because there's very little gradient.
Yeah.
There's very little gradient. They can choose wherever they want.
Yeah, but what's making the capillaries grow in the direction in which there's no growth factor?
There is growth factor. There's growth factor because remember the growth factor is produced here and it equilibrates very fast. So there's growth factor everywhere.
Yeah.
And so asymmetries, because this thing changes.
You got a growing boundary gradient.
That's right. And but also the gradient is very small.
And consumption.
So you're creating, so you know, essentially what you have is since this thing is very flat, locally, it can really go any direction because it's not dependent very much at all on the on the chemotaxis.
I would be very curious to know just how they put the bias in, because the equation itself already has the bias in it because it has a free energy term,
yes,
which is the chemotaxis.
Yes.
So any other.
But remember, in this case, chemotaxis is almost zero.
No.
You have other forces.
No, but
So think of it. You have fibronectin, right? So fibronectin is what pulls the stuff together. So that can pull stuff away from the tumor if there's essentially no effect.
And you have a pressure gradient.
And you have the pressure gradient.
I guess that's the only thing I would really believe in.
Wait, I thought this was fixed spherical.
No, in this case, you see it's moving. No. It doesn't move much, but it's free.
But you also had a diffusion term at the beginning.
And I also had diffusion, so that can also lead to some random motion. And the point is that the chemotaxis is very weak. It doesn't push it back like it did in the other case.
Hang on still. These little red things, the stuff that is discrete in the model, that is basically an individual diffuse process. You have these fields, that's a partial differential equation part.
Yes.
But then there's this discrete part of the model, as far as I understand.
Yes.
You need kind of tracking.
Correct.
Okay, so this is an individual, like an elongation equation, a diffusion process. And you can diffuse up a gradient. Just not as likely, but it can happen, right?
No, but it will. I mean, here you see it does diffuse up a gradient because you built that into the probability, right? So here it's diffusing. I mean, the gradient is.
You can diffuse the wrong direction. Each individual diffusion process can diffuse along the right direction. The overall profile just goes on average in the right direction.
It looked as fast as in one direction as the other.
Because there's hardly any gradient.
Yes, exactly. There's hardly any gradient. So other factors are coming in.
Yeah, but that sort of contradicts what you said earlier about the tip speeding up as you move toward the tumor.
No, no, but that it would, yeah, but that point is that here the profile is very flat. Okay, this is the soluble case.
I was looking at the other one.
Okay, look at the other one. Then you see it really moves right in.
There is no noise in your system, though.
Well, there
you
is some.
I mean, aside from the computing, but
right.
You have no noise.
I have no specific noise in the system.
Zero.
Yeah.
See, what I object to is the fact that there's no taking into account the underlying structure of the matrix itself.
Correct, and that we're not doing that.
And actually, if you just think about an experiment in which you were say dropping little balls down through a grid of nails, say, space in the board, you'd see them bounce, right? They bounce back and forth. But so there's some structure that's in the matrix already. The matrix.
Right. So essentially, what you can think of is that there is. We do build some in. There's a background field fibronectin. And in addition, you could build it in. So another way to so, but another. I think you're probably referring to the fact that, for example, for the chemotaxis term, that term could actually really should depend on the structure, and could be different in different regions. So we just assume that chemotaxis parameter was constant, which is a first approximation. But in fact, the structure of the ECM could be built in that somehow. By changing its value locally.
Well, we heard somebody say the other day that VEGF binds to different sites at different there are places in the matrix where it will bind and
mm-hmm.
it won't bind. And
Yeah. So this is a first approximation, and that would be then the next. I would argue is the next iteration beyond this. Clearly, it's important taking the structure of the ECM.
Since this all it depends on a lot of parameters, but it looks like you just have a core set of five, for
right.
example, that are dominant. How well do you know those constants? In other words, if you change the diffusion coefficient by order 10, does it really change the difference between soluble and soluble behavior?
No, you have to do it more. I think you have to do it more than 10 to get here. It's within. I can't tell you precise sensitivity, but when you're in the right physical regime of parameters, it's relatively insensitive. But if you jump out to something that would be very far from what you would see, then the behavior is going to be quite different.
And
so, for example, for the mechanical model, you can get a lot of the parameters by doing comparisons with simple tumor growth models like spheroids.
Mm-hmm.
So you can compare data with spheroids and get parameters and so on. So that's essentially what we do for the mechanical.
Now, does it make it, I'm coming back to his comment about the bias in the random walk. Now, you fix the grid, right?
The grid actually is dynamic here, but there is an under, so, but the underlying grid, where we're doing, in some sense, the angiogenesis, that's fixed.
That's fixed.
But
what
it's projected onto the other.
And what if you change that grid, you get different pictures?
You would get, different picture, but statistically you should be similar. So that's what I would argue. You would see a different picture, just like when we do this run, for example, here, because the seeding is random, I would get a different picture if I ran this simulation again, but roughly the statistics should be similar.
Yeah, but I would argue that nature doesn't know about the grid.
But I would argue that, so, okay, well, we should go on.
Okay.
But I would argue that true nature doesn't know about the grid. If I change the grid, I'm going to see a different morphology. But statistically, it's going to be similar. Okay, so these are just factors. Now let me show you a simulation that these guys did for the full coupled model for a long time. So, again, here's the tumor. So this is over a simulated period of 8 years. Here are initial, again, capillary sprouts, and here's the fully coupled model. So you see the capillaries grow, the tumor grows, and then, in fact, you get nodules breaking off of the main body. The tumor essentially co-opts all the vessels, and these guys move off because the way we've set up the boundary condition is that the nutrient basically is one on the outer boundary. So you have essentially selective proliferation. The tumor wants to get to the outer boundary, but also the you have the source here.
Could you do it one more time?
Yeah. So you have it grow, and then it moves towards, it's essentially selective proliferation, and then breaks off and forms essentially these little metastases. So that's the fully coupled model. Let me just show you a couple of things, then we'll quit. Actually, I won't do the systems biology, but so far we've been basically looking at tumor growth in very nice geometries, but one could ask what happens if you're really doing it in a confined geometry, like where in an organ, for example, where a tumor could really grow. So here we actually did a combined thing where we looked at, let's say, a model organ, so you can think, see the organ, but also we wanted to take into account mutation. So basically, this would be where you're changing the microphysical parameters randomly. That's one way of trying to model that. So here we did something actually very simple, which was assuming that the tumor grows with a constant velocity, but a fluctuating velocity. So in this case, it's constant. In this case, it's a constant velocity with Gaussian noise added to it, mean zero, and then reasonable variance. So we wanted to see how the tumor would grow. And I just want to show you this because it was really quite cool. So this one, of course, grows exactly as you would expect. It's growing in this confined geometry. It can't get out. So it's going to go and fill up in a particular time. So let's remember the time. So at about 5, it's made it, you know, all the way to here. So now look at what happens if it's random. So this is the point of including the, why it's important to include random fluctuations. So now, same run, except now we've added the Gaussian random noise. We'll mark the time 5, and what you'll notice is that there's a strong interaction between the randomness and the small geometry. So it can't get through. Now we're at 5. And eventually, it's going to make it through, but much later. And then once it gets into the open geometry again, it's going to grow fast, but it's highly confined by the geometry. So this was just a point to argue that while I was talking about nice continuum method, random effects are actually can be quite important, especially when combined with complex geometry. So with that, let me stop.